You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Devil's Eve, 1982, by Griffin Dunn. On day four of Dominique being on life support, Rupert Allen asked if he could speak to me alone, and I followed him outside. Rupert was a publicist and old family friend, whose clients had been Marilyn Monroe, Marlena Dietrich, and Princess Grace of Monaco. He volunteered to field and deny the countless requests from the press to interview the Dunns. His first order of business was to correct a misconception that was carried in all the papers that only added to my father's anger. They all describe Dominique as the niece of John Dunn and Joan Didion, he complained to Mom and her mother, who had just flown in from San Diego. Mom had stayed close with John and Joan since her divorce from Dad and hadn't the patience for his sibling rivalry. She didn't know about the orchid from Terrail. What difference does it make? Mom sighed, irritated to be reminded of superficial concerns that had troubled her ex-husband when they were married. Nick's right, said Gammer, my mother's mother. It makes it sound like she doesn't have parents. Dad knew his mother-in-law could barely tolerate him and was surprised by her sudden support. All right, Mom said after mulling it over. Have Rupert take care of it. Rupert led me out of earshot from the house and took a long beat before deciding to speak. I don't want to bother your parents with this, but when Dominique dies, a statement must be released to the press from the family. I put something together that is brief and dignified that I wanted you to read before I show it to Nick and Lenny. I thought maybe I didn't hear him correctly, or maybe misunderstood what he'd said, or maybe he was the one who was confused. But Dominique is not dead. She's still alive. No, of course, Rupert admitted, immediately regretting this conversation, but he plugged on. I mean, when she dies, a statement must be in place. It's how things are done. You mean, if she dies. An unexpected assault of tears ambushed me in the driveway. No one until then had ever said that Dominique would die, and I felt like a fool that it was so obvious to everyone but me. Oh, son, I'm so sorry to have brought this up. It was a terrible mistake. Please forgive me. His remorse was genuine, and I knew in that moment that he was just looking out for us, and that, of course, my sister would die. I went back inside the house, taking in all the people who'd been hugging me for days, telling me to keep strong, that Dominique was a fighter. Everyone looked different than they had only minutes earlier. What I hadn't seen, but which was suddenly clear, was that Alex and I were the last to know that the past 4 days had been one long wake. Something shifted within me, and I suddenly felt different as well. My perspective and personality took on a new formation not yet defined. But whoever I'd be in the days ahead would never be the person I was. On November 4th, 1982, 5 days after the attack, we went to Cedars-Sinai to give consent for Dominique to be taken off life support and to say our final goodbyes. We gave each other privacy when it was our turn to say goodbye. There were no tears because the reality was too unreal to accept. We talked about this day being the last time, but it didn't seem possible my sister would have no tomorrow. None of us could hear what the others said, but later Dad told me he whispered in her ear, "Give me your talent." My family used to call the Good Shepherd Church in Beverly Hills Our Lady of the Cadillacs because of the luxury cars in the parking lot and the hefty sums its well-heeled flock would drop into the collection basket. Dean Martin gave a $100 bill. Did you see that? Dad would ask my mom on the drive home from church. The Joker sat right in front of us, Alex once said, meaning Cesar Romero, who played the villain on Batman, our favorite TV show. When the funeral cortege pulled up in front of the church, my pal and designated pallbearer, Charlie, rushed to our limousine before we could exit. There has been a huge F-up. The funeral is overlapping with a wedding that is just about to end. We have to wait until it's over. From the limo, we watched a bride and groom descend the steps of the church under fistfuls of rice and suddenly stop in utter confusion at the sight of news cameras below, waiting to film the celebrities expected to arrive for the funeral. Once the wedding party and the mourners had passed each other on the steps, we finally made our move to go inside. "That's the mother! That's the father!" shouted the photographers and cameramen as they swarmed us. The rice from the wedding stuck to the wheels of Mom's chair and crunched under our shoes. "Oh, no," said my mother, as Miguel Ferrer, Charlie, and a few more of Dominique's friends came down the aisle, carrying the casket draped in pink flowers. She hated pansies. She hated the color pink. Even the florist, whom Mom had used for years, effed her over that morning. "That's not what I ordered," she said to no one in particular. Martin Manulis, Dominique's godfather, and the man who brought Dad and his family to Los Angeles 26 years earlier to work for him on Playhouse 90, gave the eulogy and described her as an Infanta Vigoya, only more beautiful. Alex and I read the Yeats poem, The Song of Wandering Angus, which was suggested by Joan. In halting voices, we barely managed to get through. "I will find out where she has gone, and kiss her lips and take her hands, and walk among long dappled grass, and pluck till time and times are done the silver apples of the moon, the golden apples of the sun." The Monsignor, presumably sober, never bothered to pronounce Dominique's name correctly, calling her Dominic, as if he didn't even know the gender of the person he was eulogizing. Every time he said Dominic, Alex's and my ears burned with rage, and we blurted out, "Neek, neek, Dominique." Heads turned our way, but we didn't care, and this time Dad didn't try to halt our outburst. We continued for the burial at Westwood Memorial Park and gathered around a freshly dug plot only yards from where Mom's best friend, Natalie Wood, had been laid to rest a year earlier. As Dominique was being lowered into the ground, a tour bus led out sightseers in front of Marilyn Monroe's crypt. The day after the disastrous funeral at Our Lady of the Cadillacs, Mom received a phone call from a woman who opened with the line, "Mrs. Dunn, I'm afraid you are now a member of a club that no one wants to belong to." On the other end was Doris Tate, mother of Sharon Tate, calling on behalf of a group called Parents of Murdered Children. Her daughter was 8 months pregnant when she was stabbed to death by Charles Manson's cult members, and she was calling to invite my mother to a meeting of her support group being held that night. Mom asked us if we would like to go, and Dad said he wasn't ready, followed by a no effing way from Alex, so I took her to the meeting at a church in Brentwood. I wheeled my mother into a space a parent had made for her in a circle of other parents. Someone brought me a chair to sit next to her, but I felt I didn't belong and was about to leave when Mom mouthed, "Please stay." The parents took turns sharing the brutal tragedies they had in common. Some had had children murdered years earlier. Others endured fresher wounds. But all seemed grateful to have one day a week to speak to the only people who would understand their loss. My mother was shy, even when talking to a group of more than five friends, let alone strangers. But to my amazement, she spoke up without prompting. She shed no tears and seemed almost eager to get it off her chest. but the disbelief in her tone made her story sound as if it had happened to somebody else. Physical affection never came easy to my mother, but when Doris Tate took her hand as she described her daughter on life support, Mom gripped it right back and plowed on. In the silent anticipation of the next volunteer, a father whose son had been killed by a stray bullet in Compton asked if I'd like to say anything. I wasn't expecting or even emotionally prepared to speak, but it felt rude to be the only one not sharing their feelings. I know everyone here is a parent, and from listening to all you have been through, I realize that to lose a child is very different than losing a sibling. It's not more or less, it's just different. Or maybe it is more. I don't know. That's as far as I got before I started to blubber. I felt like an asshole to be the only person in the room who cried, but my tears kept me from expressing an anger I had suppressed throughout the meeting. They seemed to be saying that the grief of someone who raised a child had greater meaning than mine, that of someone who had only lost a sister. I'm sure that was far from their intent, and thankfully my weeping prevented me from expressing such a self-pitying remark. On the ride back to Crescent Drive, I felt embarrassed by my display of emotion and hoped it wasn't obvious. At a red light on Wilshire, Mom turned to me and said, "You were very brave, honey. I know how hard that must have been for you." "No, Mom," I said, "you are very brave." After noticing that the crowds at the house had finally thinned, but for Mom's most diehard friends, and knowing that she had made new ones, I felt the time was right to return to my life in New York. There were no understudies for Hooters, so the play had closed the day I left, and though I was back to being an unemployed actor, I couldn't imagine ever having to pretend I was a teenager who felt awkward around girls. Alex, Dad, and I hugged Mom goodbye, and she assured us that she would be fine. As we were about to leave, she added, "Well, I guess I'll see you all at the trial." This article was excerpted from the Friday Afternoon Club, a family memoir by Griffin Dunn, published by Penguin Press. Copyright 2024 by Thomas Griffin Dunn. Citizen Chambers. Until very recently, Jim Fergie Chambers was an heir to Cox Enterprises and one of the largest family fortunes in America. With hundreds of millions of dollars on hand, a zeal for revolution, and an innate sense for confrontation, he's becoming America's go-to radical communist, by Dan Adler. Opening illustration by Dominic Bodden shows a heavily tattooed man with various protest montages swirling around him. There's a story among the St. Anne's School class of 2002, so neat as to seem apocryphal, that Jim Fergie Chambers first learned the extent of his family's fortune from a magazine. In his own telling, when he was around 11 or 12, a classmate showed him a copy of a Forbes 400 list. While Chambers had previously marveled at his grandmother's estate in the south of France, with its 75-acre vineyard, only now did he realize that Anne Cox Chambers was something like the 10th richest person in America, and among the 10 wealthiest women on earth. His Brooklyn private school possessed an air of bohemianism. The parents were successful artists, not bankers or lawyers like the ones at Manhattan schools with similar tuitions. Chambers's classmates, whom he'd largely known since kindergarten and who have known him almost exclusively as Fergie, were rich too, and they went off to elite colleges. But as they understood it, they were not that kind of rich. It wasn't talked about at all until maybe that Forbes thing, one of them recently recalled, and even that memory is kind of replaced by the tale. I'm not sure if I remember it or if I just know because it's coming up in the last 10, 15 years. Like many St. Anne's alumni, this classmate has been trying to piece together the arc Chambers has undertaken in the period since their graduation. It is not a straightforward task, given his facility for shaping the dramatic contours of his autobiography, especially lately, as the cartoonish contrast of his life have become a minor fixation in political media. His grandmother, it turned out, was the daughter of James M. Cox, the two-time governor of Ohio and 1920 Democratic presidential nominee who founded what would become Cox Enterprises, a global communications, media, and automotive conglomerate based in Atlanta, that is estimated to generate $22 billion in annual revenue. Chambers was endowed from birth with a slice of the family-owned business and briefly worked for it, but he has more recently referred to his relatives as the Cox Klux Klan. The Coxes are worth a reported $26.8 billion, putting them a bit below the Waltons and Kochs, and just above the Lauders and Hearst in the rankings of American wealth. Chambers' cousin Alex Taylor is the fourth family member to serve as Cox Enterprises CEO. His father, Jim Cox Chambers, is part owner of the Atlanta Hawks and chairs the Bard College Board of Trustees. He and Chambers' mother, Lauren Hamilton, the daughter of pioneering computer scientist Margaret Hamilton, divorced when their son was two. Jim Cox Chambers later married the daughter of billionaire Saudi arms dealer Adnan Khashoggi. Fergie Chambers, 39, was in and out of rehab and mental institutions starting at 11. After St. Anne's, he drifted among marriages, businesses, and callings. Money was a through line, though, and so was communism. In middle school, a history teacher gave him linen to read, and he was hooked. He eventually decorated his body in Soviet-inspired tattoos, including one on his neck that read ACAB, until he modified it to create a Russian word amounting to attaboy. In the spring of 2022, shortly after the war in Ukraine broke out, Chambers was in Sicily with Stella Schnabel, then his sometime girlfriend and the mother of his fourth child. Schnabel, the daughter of painter and director Julian, went to school with Chambers growing up, and they reunited a few years ago. Already in Europe and sensing an opportunity, Chambers headed to the Donbas region and to Russia, where he wrote dispatches touting the righteousness of Vladimir Putin's invasion. When Chambers returned to the U.S., members of the Cox family and their lawyers asked him, he said, to sign paperwork, promising that if he went to Russia again, he would dissociate his holdings as an heir. He could be seen as an unregistered foreign agent, they said, which he understood to be a threat. A spokesperson for Cox Enterprises said the company doesn't comment on family matters. The following year, Chambers learned Cox Enterprises had invested $10 million to fund the Atlanta Public Safety Training Center, a planned law enforcement facility known colloquially as Cop City. The new construction has drawn intense protest, in which Chambers participated and which he financially supported when he lived there, and a resulting legal crackdown that has included domestic terrorism and racketeering charges. Taylor, his CEO cousin, led the project's fundraising as the honorary chair of Atlanta's police fund, and the editorial board of the Cox-owned Atlanta Journal-Constitution wrote in support of the planned facility. ATL is corrupt as hell, Chambers wrote on X, and the Cox family are enemies of the people. Then, this past July, Chambers made an announcement. I've become the first Cox to fully detach from the company, he wrote in an expansive statement. In the past, I withheld from aggressively pursuing such a move because I maintained some family bonds and because I was no more at odds with Cox than with any other tentacle of the American bourgeoisie. Cop City, he said, changed his thinking. He agreed to trade his shares for lump sums, including a $250 million initial payout. I got A-Rod's Texas Rangers deal in one day, he told me this fall, with a mix of astonishment and pride. Unshackled and flush, Chambers set out to fund his causes and make what he acknowledges is a spectacle of himself. Amid his jittery streams of social media posts, he homed in on his family and background. As the Israel-Hamas war began last fall, he made a list of relatives or relatives by proxy. His father, his stepmother, his cousin, his stepbrother, Schnabel's father and brother, and the ways each aided Israel or fell short of supporting Palestine. With his appetite for recognition and mostly unerring projection of certainty, Chambers was a quick stand-in for the larger cultural convulsion unfolding at so many American institutions, such as Ivy League schools and art and literary magazines. Egged on, he engaged with many of the tabloid and right-wing media outlets that were more frequently seeking him out. He had moved to New Hampshire for tax advantages, but continued to operate a gym and farm on the land he owns in Alford, Massachusetts, where his ostensible affinity for guns prompted concerned local news coverage. Chambers has not become an influential political figure, but he has a tendency to conduct himself as if he has, making for a disorienting micro-celebrity infamy. He had long been a wayward scion, but he was now an emblem of some larger dynastic corrosion. His relationships with his parents had deteriorated beyond repair. Mother Jones and Air Mail interviewed him. A Rolling Stone reporter followed him to a protest at Cop City. In December, a producer for Dr. Phil reached out. Chambers grew up in his mother's brownstone in Brooklyn. During one of our first conversations, he described the environment at school as the fallout of the sort of 80s bohemian bourgeoisie. His father was in Los Angeles for a large chunk of his childhood, but had an apartment on the floor above Yoko Ono at the Dakota. At six, Chambers began seeing a psychiatrist because he was still wetting his bed, and he said that he was medicated before age 10. The amount of focus and attention and pathologization from an early age was pretty intense, he said. He was having tantrums and went to a psych ward in the 8th grade, where he said he was put in a straitjacket and injected with Thorazine. Chambers said a 16-year-old patient there raped him. Chambers started smoking cigarettes and weed. He switched to LSD when he left the ward, and his parents began having him tested for drugs. In high school, he struggled with heroin and crack and was institutionalized more regularly. A friend saw him shoot up at CBGB and called his parents. They staged an intervention. When he and his father took a chartered jet to Utah for him to attend a wilderness rehab program, he said, a doorman from the Dakota came with them as security. He snuck heroin on board and took it into the bathroom. The elder Chambers broke down the door. His son punched him in the face. His father didn't return request for comment. In the view of some classmates, Chambers was reasonably well-liked and socially integrated at St. Anne's, though not entirely esteemed. They recalled him shifting identities in a manner that went beyond workaday teenage phases. He said he was gay at one time and claimed membership in the Bloods at another. As one peer put it, he was all these other things before a rich kid. No one thought that he was going anywhere, another said, and neither did he. Chambers remembered himself as more of an outsider. I mostly hung out with the kids who came around St. Anne's to sell drugs and smoke cigarettes outside, he said. Chambers has claimed that his classmate Lena Dunham got him kicked out of school by informing the administration that he was selling drugs. He had been dating her friend, who attended another private school in the neighborhood. Some classmates remembered the sequence of events differently and attributed his dismissal to a wider range of misbehavior. Dunham didn't respond to a request for comment. She didn't effing like me, he recalled, and I didn't like effing Lena Dunham either. Other classmates, he said, were better known than him, but not as wealthy, and he rattled off some names. Jemima Kirk, Ava Amuri, Francesco Clementi's daughter, in his default free associative manner, before letting out a snicker. Chambers can speak more or less uninterrupted for hours, with a sense of awe at his own intrepidness. He's fond of Huey Newton's notion that anything can be revolutionary at a particular point in time, often locating world historical valences in his personal trajectory. His nearly 3 years in psych wards, rehabs, and a little bit of jail, but not a ton of jail, were, he said, a big part of how I ended up where I ended up, coming up against the state in that way, or coming up against the discipline of the ruling class in that way. When we talked on this occasion, Chambers was dealing with a blood clot from a jiu-jitsu tournament. He has also boxed and practiced Muay Thai. He had recently returned from Atlanta, where 3 of his children live with his first wife, and where he attended a conference organized by the International People's Assembly, a network of anti-imperialist and anti-capitalist groups. Chambers returned to St. Anne's in time to graduate. He figured somebody's donation helped his cause. He attended noon AA meetings at a church next to the school throughout his senior year. He was upset after breaking up with his high school girlfriend and took his first of several gap years. He worked on his father's organic vegetable farm in Columbia County for cash, and obsessed with Henry Miller, drove his dog to California in his mother's old Volvo. I'm sleeping with women, he remembered, and writing about it like some total effing dilettante little piece of shit. He protested the Iraq War, got swept up in a few catch-and-release arrests, and canvassed for Ralph Nader in Washington, D.C. His interest in Lenin had by then extended to a broader Russophilia. While visiting a friend at Bard, he saw a blonde Russian girl named Anya Vostrova and declared his intent to marry her. He began attending the college the next year. He'd been staying sober, but after seeing the liberal arts students excited about their first experiments with weed, he felt a competitive streak kick in. He cooked crack in the dorms and nodded out in someone's room, and Bard asked him to leave. Around this time, Chambers temporarily dropped Fergie, a nickname his parents had decided on while he was in the womb. He worked for his godfather, Chris Good, an occasional film producer who opened the 80s nightclub area, studied acting, and played baseball. After Aaron Boone knocked his beloved Red Sox out of the 2003 American League Championship Series, he blacked out in Brooklyn and started a few fights. He woke up yelling at his mother and Vostrova, now his girlfriend. He headed back upstate to AA meetings near Bard, where he fell in love with a group of older Christian men. Chambers declared himself Catholic, preferring its pathway for pretension to his new friend's Protestantism, and railed against contraception. He disavowed punk rock and all the rest of his old identity and said he was just a conservative American guy named Jim. Chambers proposed to Vostrova, a child of middle-class immigrants who grew up on Long Island, when he was 21 years old. She was pregnant 2 weeks later. When they married at La Petite Fontanille, his grandmother's estate in Provence, the ceremony stretched over several days. Humbled and newly moored to tradition, Chambers decided to go to work for the family business. "We've made something of ourselves in this country," he thought. Or something. Chambers went to the Mannheim Auto Auction on the west side of Atlanta. He was in a management training program, but emphasized to me that he related better to both the redneck white people and the cats from the hood, who dealt with the actual cars and the layoffs that arrived with the Great Recession. Vostrova became pregnant again, and Chambers showed up to events with his family in the Tony Buckhead area. But he was miserable, chain-smoking parliaments, and watching his weight balloon from a diet of Chick-fil-A and sweet tea. His grandmother was on Bard's board at this point, before his father eventually took her seat, and the Ancox Chambers Alumni Center is one of the first buildings you see driving onto campus. Chambers got a call from Leon Botstein, the college's president of nearly 50 years, who has received some scrutiny recently for the donations Bard received from Jeffrey Epstein. "We're a family to you," Chambers remembered him saying. "You should come back here." The idea was that he could study economics. But in about a month, he was in Russia, in Russian and writing classes, and starting a baseball team. Chambers had by now gotten his first trust fund payout of around $1 million and a bit of income through an investment. As he saw it, though, he was still in the dark. "I don't know if I have to work for money. No one's told me anything." James M. Cox was born in a log cabin on an Ohio farm in 1870. While working as a young reporter at the Cincinnati Enquirer, he found a mentor and a local businessman who had won a seat in Congress. At 28, with the help of the congressman and money borrowed from friends and family, Cox acquired the Dayton Daily News. He bought the Springfield Daily News several years later. Both papers are still owned by Cox Enterprises. Over the next decade, Cox won his own seat in Congress, was elected governor of Ohio, and built a five-bedroom French Renaissance home in a Dayton suburb. In 1920, he ran for president with Franklin D. Roosevelt as his running mate, but the ticket lost in a rout to Warren G. Harding. Cox returned to the media business. He bought the Miami Metropolis newspaper and aired the first television broadcast in Atlanta, where he owned the paper that would become the Journal Constitution, as well as its affiliated AM station. WSB Radio operated for a period out of a colonial revival-style mansion known as White Columns, and WSB-TV adopted the tagline Eyes of the South. When Cox died in 1957, his son Jim Jr. took over the company as CEO and nearly one-third owner. He expanded into cable and automotive, and had a late-in-life conservative turn, ordering his newspaper editors in 1972 to get behind Richard Nixon. Today, the family is for all intents exclusively aligned with Democrats, and the business revolves primarily around cable, internet, and the automotive sector, though its media holdings have the more visible profile. The company acquired the news site Axios in 2022 after selling a majority stake in its broadcast stations a few years earlier. When Jim Jr. died, his two half-sisters came into 95% ownership of Cox Enterprises. Barbara chaired the newspapers in Dayton, and Anne, Fergie's grandmother, in Atlanta. They expanded the family's social and philanthropic stature. Anne had been an early supporter of Jimmy Carter. The Georgia governor's mansion had no pool, so he swam across the road at hers and became ambassador to Belgium once he was elected president. As with so many American dynasties, the Cox heirs eventually strayed further afield. The third generation includes Fergie's father, Jim, the most devoutly eccentric of his siblings and cousins, an alternative medicine enthusiast who amassed stacks of aging newspapers in his Manhattan apartment. According to his son, he was Anne's favorite child. Some of that had to do with him kind of being a real person who loved punk rock, Chambers said. Jim met Chambers' mother, Lauren Hamilton, at Bard. Hamilton grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where her mother, Margaret, worked on NASA projects at MIT and coined the term software engineering as she programmed the flight operating systems for the Apollo 11 mission. Chambers has had strong relationships with both of his grandmothers. After Anne's death in 2020, Margaret is the only blood relative with whom he remains close. Jim and Lauren married shortly after graduation, and both soon had small parts in Amos Poe's 1984 mafia noir Alphabet City. Fergie was born in 1985. Lauren left acting behind, and after their divorce, Jim moved to Los Angeles, where he made documentaries, pursued dancing, and wore his hair in dreadlocks. He saw Fergie every other Christmas in Provence, and when he took his son to the Super Bowl in Atlanta in 1994. Jim moved back to New York when Fergie began to struggle more severely as a teenager. During the 2000 World Series between the Mets and Yankees, he called Fergie and told him he was thinking of going to a game. He picked his son and a friend up in a limo, and they sat next to Rudy Giuliani. At Yankee Stadium, Fergie said he saw more clearly that something is really going on, something a little bit more than Grandma has a nice car. Later, reading the German sociologist Max Weber's The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, he had a theoretical basis for his family's relationship to its wealth. "Put your head down. You're one of God's chosen," he said. "My family's particularly hush-hush. I think WASP tend to be that way. Maybe a family of Italian shipping billionaires are a little more open about it." That's one of the really easy ways for me to counter their agenda, he supposed, remembering a lesson he learned at a young age. "Just to take my pants off. Here we are. This is what's going on. Hey." After Bard, Chambers, still Catholic and sober, spent a few years living part-time in Russia with Vostrova. The couple planned to unite under the same church with their two children. Chambers thought he would convert his wife, but after taking in the guys with deep operatic voices and beards and cathedrals built by Catherine the Great, I'm like, okay, I was wrong, you're right, and I think I'm Russian Orthodox. He and Vostrova had their third child and decided to move. With his trust fund maturing, Chambers had a couple million more dollars, and when he went to Atlanta for his grandmother's 90th birthday party, he heard about a few gyms for sale. "So that's how I met this totally apolitical lady who was unhappy with her marriage," Chambers said. One of Chambers' more notable registers on the national radar came in 2020 during Marjorie Taylor Greene's conspiracy-fueled campaign for Congress. Chambers, it emerged, had employed the future U.S. representative at his Alpharetta gym in 2012. As Greene sought her district's Republican nomination, she often invoked her Christian faith, and Chambers aired some of the gym's gossip on X. "The extramarital affairs you had with Justin and Craig," he wrote, "those were Jesus approved, right?" The allegation didn't get any press until after Greene won her primary a few months later. The Daily Mail ultimately enshrined it under the headline, "Embattled QAnon Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene openly cheated on her husband of 25 years with a polyamorous tantric sex guru and then moved on to another affair with a manager at her gym." Greene called the story ridiculous tabloid garbage spread by an avowed communist and another attempt to smear my name because I'm the biggest threat to the Democrat socialist agenda. Neither man denied an affair to the Mail. Chambers found himself once again restless. "I'm starting to have this feeling," he said, "of just like, where have I been for these last years?" He took a painting class and went to the Prado in Madrid, revisiting the prospect of an artistic future. He went with friends to Amsterdam. He had recently begun smoking weed again and was drinking with no real trouble. They headed to his grandmother's in France, where Vestrova had gone with the kids, and saw them for a few days before flying to Morocco and Iceland. "I don't know what I'm doing," he recalled. "I'm being super manic." A woman at a bar in Reykjavik asked him for a cigarette, and he spent 5 days with her. When he came back, Vestrova read his Facebook messages. "I don't want to be married anymore," he told his wife. "I don't know who the F I am." He couch surfed in Atlanta and read political theory. One of his father's ex-girlfriends came to town. Chambers met her for drinks and said they spent the night together. When he woke up hungover, he went to a cafe and saw Andre 3000 sitting at the counter, as well as an incredibly beautiful girl. He declared his intent to marry Cameron Park. On some occasions, when he provokes backlash online, Chambers' detractors resurface his mugshot. His relationship with Park spanned one of the most volatile periods of his adult life thus far, starting from his earliest days. He was arrested in 2013 on battery and false imprisonment charges, and amid his retelling of his life story, he brought the episode up before I could ask about it. He claimed, though, that because he had been on a week-long bender, "I don't even know the details, man. We go effing apeshit," he said. "I'm trying to throw myself out the window. I definitely hit her. She definitely hit me." Park declined to comment. The admission seemed to function as a gesture of self-awareness, a kind of inoculation. "I understand people who don't want to F with me," Chambers added. An incident report from the arrest said that, according to Park, Chambers broke her laptop and phone, and that when she tried to leave the apartment, he slammed the door closed on her leg and forced her back in. When she tried to leave again, she stated, he pulled her by her hair down a concrete hall and banged her head on the floor. There was no mention of Park hitting him, but she stated that she pushed him to get him off of her before going to a nearby friend's house and waiting for the police. The report said that Chambers initially told an officer that the argument did not turn physical before acknowledging that he shut Park's leg in the door and asked her not to leave. According to Chambers, while he was in jail, the Coxes sent the Atlanta criminal defense attorney Ed Garland, a sixth-generation lawyer who had previously represented T.I., Ben Roethlisberger, and Ray Lewis. Chambers claimed that Park told authorities that they were both strung out and didn't know what happened. According to a person familiar with the night's circumstances, Park didn't know at the time that Chambers was wealthy. She ultimately did not pursue charges. Chambers was expanding his activist ambitions. He wanted to become a political person in a meaningful way. He met housing and Occupy Wall Street organizers and donated some money. He protested when Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson. He went back to rehab, but it didn't stick. Personal inventories and making amends didn't improve his outlook. "I feel so guilty about what I've done to this woman," he said, "what I did to Anya, what I've done with my whole life as a rich kid who's a waste." He and Park left AA and opened a cafe boutique that stocked Rachel Comey and Enric Vigskov. They married in 2014. In a Facebook post in 2016, he wrote about what a recent night in jail said about his whiteness and wealth. He had been sleepwalking nude and high when a neighbor called the cops. When Barbara Cox died in 2007, most of the rest of the company was wrapped up in Ann's estate. As Ann entered her 90s, Chambers said, his family started to get freaked out about estate planning. In 2013, she won approval from a Georgia court to dissolve the trust, established by her father in 1941, that held her company shares, splitting it between family members and charities. A Cox spokesperson described this at the time as a maneuver related solely to the Cox family's goal of maintaining future ownership and control of Cox Enterprises. One upshot, Chambers said, was that he started to get more money faster and through a grantor retained annuity trust, a financial instrument used to minimize estate taxes. His assets accumulated to more than $5 million, and he ramped up his political funding and held organizing meetings at his gym. In the coming years, he brought supplies and trucks to the protest at the Standing Rock Reservation, where he said he saw everything that we recognize in America, what it was built on, and who we took it from, and how we did it, and how we do everything as a nation. In 2017, he bought 90 acres of land in Georgia. He and Park were joined by a man from the reservation, as well as another couple they met there. The Georgia group eventually came to include 14 people, trying to grow food and hold retreats on 350 acres, but the project never took full flight. Too many anarchists, Chambers said, no party leadership. By then, he had come to see that income wouldn't be an issue. His media profile began to rise. He made the local news in August 2017 when one of his gyms banned police and active military members. Chambers told an NBC affiliate that he didn't want a hetero jock space. When tabloids picked up the story, they usually described him as a lifelong activist. It took Bearing Arms, a news site for Second Amendment enthusiasts, to make the Cox connection by following a trail of Reddit comments. Park was pulled over for drunk driving and resisted arrest. When she received a 40-day sentence in a courtroom in February 2019, Chambers said the entire Morgan County Sheriff's Department was there to stand up and stare him down. According to another person in the room, the police presence was unremarkable, and Chambers began yelling at the judge. Chambers and Park were already thinking about leaving Georgia, and Massachusetts had legalized marijuana in 2016. They wanted a fresh start. Chambers bought a house in the Berkshires and resolved that when he started over with a land project, he would do so in a more principled way. Chambers grew weed and got into martial arts very seriously. One day, he said, 5 years after they married, he got back from the gym and Park was gone. Chambers was 35 and panicking. While he was in Las Vegas in early 2020 for his birthday and a Conor McGregor UFC bout, his dad called. His grandmother was 100 years old and dying. He flew to Atlanta to sit at her feet. Anne's death briefly brought him closer to Jim. They smoked weed together for the first time and went to the NBA All-Star Game in Chicago. Chambers went to New York. He hadn't wanted to be there much since he was a teenager, but he intended to make music with a cousin and slay Tinder to cope. One day, he met Park at St. Ambrose in the West Village for lunch. During their meal, Chambers looked across the restaurant and spotted his old classmate Stella Schnabel. "It's Fergie from St. Anne's," Chambers reminded her. Schnabel came over to his table and looked him and Park over. This was his wife, he explained, because they weren't yet legally divorced. Schnabel had heard he had lots of kids. Schnabel's father was nominated for an Oscar, and her mother opened an Azadine Alaya boutique in Soho. "There is no downside to being a Schnabel," her brother Vito, an art dealer, once told the New York Observer. In her senior year of high school, Stella began dating Red Hot Chili Peppers guitarist John Frusciante, and Julian made the art for the band's next album, a portrait of his daughter. She had been an actor and poet in the past. Now she had a store at her house in Brooklyn. She invited Chambers to see it, and they exchanged numbers. "I hope you like those truffles," Chambers remembered her texting after she left. "Find me someone to have a baby with." "Immediately, my thought is, well, that's going to be me," he said. A little while later, they had dinner and slept together. He needed to go plant weed the next day, so she joined him in Massachusetts, where they had dinner with his mother. The coronavirus pandemic loomed, ending Chambers' plan to go to Thailand for Muay Thai training camp. He and Schnabel quarantined together. He wanted a real Marxist-Leninist organization on the land, which he would call the Berkshire Communist, and a place where like-minded people from New York and Boston could gather, study, eat, and garden. Chambers inherited around $7 million when Anne died, and between that and his investment dividends, he placed his assets at the time near $10 million. He started a gym program in his garage and paid a top-tier UFC coach to teach free classes for those who were down to tolerate communist politics. Chambers and Schnabel were on and off from the beginning. "We are such bratty kids," he said. "We love each other so much, but it's been really fiery sometimes." They had been apart a few months when he returned to New York to join the protest following the murder of George Floyd. But she drove in from the Hamptons to pick him up when he was arrested. They headed back to Massachusetts, and he said they took San Pedro cactus as they sat by a bonfire. They decided to have a child. One Thursday night last fall, I met Chambers during one of his occasional trips back to New York. We walked a few blocks from the Bowery Hotel in the East Village, where he and Schnabel usually stay. It's owned by Eric Good, a friend of Schnabel's and the brother of Chambers' godfather, from whom Chambers has been estranged. The streets were crowded with bar hoppers and bankers returning home from work. We passed a group of cops standing on the sidewalk, and Chambers began oinking and spit on the ground in their direction. "Yeah, you too," one of the officers said. "Aye, F you," Chambers replied as we continued to walk. "F you, MF. Come back, dumbass." Chambers turned around, and the two men brought their faces within inches. A few outdoor diners were starting to look on. "You spat at me almost." "I didn't spit at you," Chambers countered. "Keep on walking," the cop said. Chambers called him fat boy and said he wasn't afraid. Another officer encouraged me to remove my friend from the situation. Chambers walked away on his own. "The whole effing city hates all of you MFs," he shouted as he backpedaled. "Your day is coming. Your day is coming." "I'm not stupid," he said as we continued down the street. "That's the thing. I'll play within the boundaries of what you can F around with." But he also felt some sense of duty to make use of his impunity, since there are a lot of people that wish they could do that. He looked up at the football game playing on a television inside a bar we were passing. "Man, they're getting smoked. I'm a Giants fan." Wearing a Fila polo, a flat-brimmed trucker hat, and a dangling boxing glove charm from his ear, he seemed a bit haggard but comfortable. Chambers didn't like the city anymore. "Same effing played-out story as everybody else. It ain't what it used to be. And usually came to town only because of Schnabel, though he didn't mind having her mother watch their 2.5-year-old son. On this occasion, he was eager to be here. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.